this week on Writers, Inc.
Well, I've learned that just you need to be in as many places as possible. Not just Amazon, not just Barnes & Noble, not just the indie stores. I mean, they move a lot of copies, but also libraries and the big box stores, especially the big box stores.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
J.P. Reinflush.
Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. J.P.
Hello.
What the heck? He just wandered in here.
I did. I got one of your links and just snuck in.
I thought we changed the locks.
Well, you didn't.
What happened was there was this like whole transmorph thing that happened with Jenna. She just suddenly transformed into J.P. That's what happened.
They were the same person all along.
Right.
The same person all along.
Took off the mustache.
So what's been going on? When was the last time you were on here? I guess it's been at least a year, right? Year and a half?
I think so. Something around there. Yeah, it's been wild. Recently, the day job let me go. But luckily, things have been going pretty well in the book world. So I'm taking a shot at full-time author.
Cool. Congratulations.
Excellent. Yeah.
I know how scary that can be. I've been there, done that.
Yeah.
But honestly, like for me, like putting my feet to the coals like that, like that's what really got me moving, because you don't have a choice, so you hustle.
It's a little bit like swimming the ocean without a floaty, but also there are sharks.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
And you just had a pond. Very, very successful Kickstarter, JP, if I can
did.
Just your own horn for a little bit. So
yeah, it was really fun. I ran for a cozy queer fantasy called Mosswood Apothecary. It went really well, and I'm planning to do another Kickstarter in October. So
yeah, I'm a little jealous of the Kickstarter success.
Every time I hear Kickstarter, like I add it to my list of things I need to do, and then I never actually pull the trigger on doing
Same.
It.
It's just really nice because it sort of is a proof of concept, because like I wanted to make a book with a lot of art in it, but realistically, if you just went straight to the shelves with a book with a lot of art, who's gonna really want all of those art pieces? Are you truly proving a point or not? So the Kickstarter really proved that people wanted it, so I can have these like special editions, and then I can also have these standard editions that maybe have a little bit of less art, but that way I know that there are people that want them.
I'm excited for it.
I guess from my standpoint, I'm not sure if my fan base would participate or not, because they come at me from all these other sources that they're used to. Like, do you see your existing fans migrating over to Kickstarter, or is this a brand new group of people?
I saw a few, and I saw a few of the brand new people. I think that there was probably half of them that I don't know them per se. I don't know where they came from. And those are probably the people that are on the Kickstarter sort of ecosphere, and they're more interested in, how the Kickstarters that are successful and sort of jumping on those. I mean, I've been on Kickstarter for years. I think I've backed like almost 100 projects because I have an obsession. So I know the feeling. Like there are some projects on there that I don't necessarily know the author, but I'll find that on Kickstarter and just join it because it looks cool.
Yeah. I am so excited to get my book. Like the hardcover is gorgeous. You have like foil and these beautiful end papers and sprayed edges and all these illustrations.
Yeah, nice.
It's awesome.
Very nice.
We have a listener question.
We have a listener question. And ironically, it's from another podcast. That's how far our reach goes. Sample Chapter Podcast asks, if I want to change my paperbacks from exclusive on Amazon to wide, what's the best way to get my covers to match across all platforms? Will I need to change anything?
You have to change everything.
You know,
right?
Well, I mean, I take this question to mean like, you know, I designed my cover to the specifications given to me by Amazon. So do I need to do something fancy, special? And the answer is you probably will, because it seems like no matter what platform you're using, there's like slightly different dimensions. So you just need to check with that platform, get the dimensions for the manuscript that you're providing, you know, and there's all kinds of things that change the dimensions of that cover, including like even down to like what type of paper you pick. Like if you pick cream or you could pick white, it impacts the size of the cover, how many pages total, those sorts of things. So like using just draft to digital as an example, like you go to D2D, you upload the manuscript, it'll give you a template for the cover, and then you can resize your cover for that template. And most platforms will do that.
Yeah, and I was gonna say, I don't know who your cover designer is, but I know when I did mine, they offered like they're just select which options you want, ebook, Amazon, Ingram, whatever all the different options were, and it's the same price. So I just took all of them in case you need them for future. I don't know why you wouldn't. So yeah, depending on who's doing your cover and who did your originals, they might be able to give you the other formats.
Yeah, they're most likely jumping to Ingram next. That tends to be the next landing site. And Ingram will provide templates. I mean, in my experience, the paperback from KDP and Ingram tend to both fit. Like you can usually get those to work. Unless you start changing stuff, you know, like Kevin said, like the paper and all that. What I've been doing, I've kind of run into a similar problem because now I'm with Simon and Schuster, and my print costs are so much lower with them than they are with Ingram and some of these other guys. So I'm like slowly moving my back catalog over to Simon and Schuster. So I'm having to do this with all of them. And what I'm doing now that I should have done before is when I get the cover designs from whoever creates them, I'm getting the PST files, the Photoshop files, because once you have that, it's real easy to make the changes to accommodate these different templates. If you don't get it, you know, like let's say, like I did a ton of covers through 99 Designs, which is a great way to get covers. But you know, the people that work there, the talent, like they come and go. Like it's near impossible to find the same artist, you know, over and over again. So, you know, if a year goes by, you may not be able to track them down, and then you have to start from scratch. So, try to get the PST files, I guess, is
I'm
my
just going to make that a Kevin's rule of writing. You should always get the pay the extra money. They're always going to want extra money, but pay it and get the editable files, the source files. Every time.
All right. What is in the news?
Speaking of source files, Pizza Hut debuts a Book It app. Did not expect to see Pizza Hut in our news, but here we go. In a follow-up to our previous story about exploitation of Pizza Hut's Book It program, the Book It app has now arrived. This is the first time Pizza Hut has offered the app to parents who can use it to track their kids' reading and incentivize them to keep up the good work during the summer with a free personal pan pizza. The debut co coincides with Book It Summer of Stories, Pizza Hut's summer reading program launching June 1st, encouraging parents to stay engaged with their kids' reading habits. Kids who achieve their reading goal can get one of those vied for personal pan pizzas. My brain did not want to read that word. Vied for personal pan pizzas in the months of June, July, and August. Because in the
Man.
middle of July is when you want a hot, steamy
I just love this. After we
pizza.
did
All
that
the time.
story about that journalist who wrote about her grandma being a retired teacher and their exploitation of the Book It program, and it's like, oh, now parents can hopefully they will actually make sure their kids read these books. So.
I got all excited. I downloaded the app on the phone. I sat my 7-year-old down with it. I told her what it was all about and showed her the app. And her first question to me was like, "Yeah, but can we do Domino's? Because I don't like Pizza Hut." Oh. Oh,
Well,
yeah, I don't know what's going to happen.
I'd be like, yes, we'll track it and we'll get you the
Yeah, why not? You go get the one for Pizza Hut, and you just grab her a Domino's on the way back.
I think that's what I'm going to have to do. And I'm not even sure that we have a Pizza Hut near us. But I honestly, I love Pizza Hut. Like back in the day, like when I was in college, that was one of my first jobs. I delivered pizzas for Pizza Hut. And like there's something about their pizza. Like it's probably my favorite out of all of those.
Remember dessert pizza?
Yeah, you
Oh
do
yeah.
get one.
Like cherries and stuff on it. I would eat all that.
You have to go into an actual Pizza Hut though, and it has to be one of the huts, you know, one of the ones that looks like a hut, because that's the authentic Pizza Hut experience. The smells, the sounds, every, you know, That's the environment I'm looking for. There's not very
Highly
many of those left.
unsanitary salad
Oh yeah.
bar.
Oh no. Yeah.
I recall we did this for, I think, high school, where if we read a certain number of pages that we would get to go to Pizza Hut. So it was like a big thing. So this is cool. I like
Yeah.
this.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I like seeing stuff like this come make a comeback. Next up, Business Insider commits to AI and lays layoffs after circulating reading list with fake books. I'm sorry. Did not mean to laugh at that. After at least two major newspapers printed an inaccurate AI-generated reading list, it is now reportedly not the first AI-generated book list with invented titles in the media. Last May, a Business Insider editor sent staffers a memo suggesting, quote, beacon books, memoirs, and business titles that could help inform their journalism. The list appears to be AI-generated, including several titles that don't exist or were misattributed to other authors. The news was revealed after Business Insider told staff last week that they are, quote, going all in on AI and would lay off about 20% of staff. That sounds like a great move. So I still say this is a grand opportunity for authors. You go find the titles that they are promoting that don't exist and write those books right now. Just
Yeah, there you
go
go.
do it.
I'm waiting for what, like these to start coming out of Goodreads and like some of these daily emails that we get. Like how far along are I mean they must be at the point where they're starting to use AI to generate some of that stuff. And like once they realize the cost savings, it's just going to happen.
Yeah.
Movie reviews too, like all these different things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I don't know. I did a whole thing today when I was recording Wordslinger podcast about how it is possible to do this kind of thing and be lazy about it and generate it. I think though that what's going to come from this is first of all, you're going to have a lot of gaffes like this if people aren't actually paying attention. But I think what's going to happen is those who are using AI as an assistive tool to help them, but are going through and doing the work, of rewriting it, rereading, vetting everything themselves. They're the ones that are going to kind of rise to the top on this whole thing. And so I think this will equal itself out, is what I'm saying.
Didn't we have a story like a month or two ago about somebody, one of the organizations using AI to pick the winners or their
Oh yeah, I
nominees for
don't
their
think we
best
talked
books?
about it on air, but it was Worldcon, the ones that
I'm guessing we're going to see some of these fake titles start showing up in awards, nominations, like on
Fact.
those lists too.
Even more reason, man. I'm going to start checking every one of these lists. I'm going to check them. I'm going to vet these for them, and then I'm going to make sure that I have pre-orders on titles that match those books.
Well, now we all know your strategy.
That's
Yeah.
it. Yeah.
Who's going to be faster?
Anyone else who would do this is too lazy to do it the right way, so I got no competition.
There you go.
All right. Final story. Meta aims to fully automate ad creation using AI. Wow. This fits, clicks right in. Meta is gearing up to let AI take over the entire ad making process on Facebook and Instagram by the end of the next year. Soon, businesses will be able to upload a product image, set a budget, and let AI handle the rest, creating visuals, writing copy, and selecting the best target audience. Smaller brands in particular could gain a lot with limited resources and no big creative teams. AI-generated ads offer a shortcut.
AI is your ad agency now. I'm sure nothing will go wrong.
You're going to have AI generating the ads and then AI bots responding to the ads and all about fake books, by the way. And so
That are nominated for
that are
awards.
nominated
Yeah.
for awards.
I would honestly be all in on this if it was any good at it. I create Amazon ads almost on or Facebook ads almost on a daily basis, like right now, because I've got a new title coming out. So every day as part of my tasks, I create a new Facebook ad. And it always offers the AI suggested, like alternative, text. And it's horrible.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Like every single time. I have yet to see one that like I would actually want to put on an ad. So like now they're going to add the images to that. So like what are these images going to look like? And it might be entertaining as a Facebook user to just kind of read through them and see them because they're going to be so sloppy and silly, but like I wouldn't want to depend on it in any way, at least not
No,
yet.
the misinformation is what worries me. Like, is it going to be
Yeah, I mean, because you just you just don't know what it's going to throw in there, you know, and
Yeah.
like, unless you're watching it. And like the point of a lot of this is people, you know, they're trying to save time, you know, which means that they're not watching it. They're not reviewing the content. They're looking for a way to automate the entire process and step away so they can go work on something else. And that's how all this garbage slips out.
Yeah. And
Yeah.
it's already very difficult in Facebook to target an audience. Like you have to go through and uncheck all the AI stuff. So having less control over targeting also concerns me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want AI generating things like this, assets for me. But I would want AI to kind of help me like target an audience better, you know. And that's where I see this all going. That's kind of what I'm talking about. It's like that's assistive technology, not
Yeah.
it's not doing the creative work for you. It's not do, you know. We shouldn't be using AI to do the work
Yes,
for us. We
helping
should be
not
using
taking
it
over.
to, yeah,
Yeah.
make it better. And right now it doesn't seem to make it better.
Yeah, and like the difficult part with it is when it starts creating like the visuals or like very clear copy that reads as AI, it makes it very difficult as you as an author promoting to an audience because if they catch wind that it's AI, you're likely to go under a witch hunt. This happens a lot in the TikTok space, especially. Which is why, like, I just steer clear of this because I don't want that sort of flack. Because especially in the cozy queer space, like, we like to vet our illustrators and show like who did it because it helps to sort of promote that ideology.
Right.
It's just it's tough. I get the assisted part of it, but I think that when we just keep filling the space with more of this visual and copy that sort of feels a little
Yeah.
lifeless,
Yeah.
yeah.
It's all going to
How do
be
you
sitting
rise
there.
up?
How do you stand out as an author when all the ads are the same? I don't
That's
know.
right.
Yeah.
And the answer is you do them yourself. That's what's going
Exactly.
to happen. That's that rise to the top part, you
I
know.
do my stick illustrations. Be like, look, I drew this myself. Might work.
Those are going to stand out. I have a
That would
story, by
work.
the way, when I worked in when I had my own little video production business and I was doing commercials for people, right? There's a in Houston, there's a business called CNS Scrap Metal, and they had the crappiest green screen commercials. Like they would be wearing green shirts and stuff, like not even thinking, like the background was all wrinkled. So this is like crappy CG effect of them flying on a carpet or something. And their whole shtick was that they took $2, they paid in $2 bills. I reached out to them and said, look, 10K, and I will give you a polished professional ad that you can run. And they wrote back and told me, we pay $100 to get these done. All right, some kid does them and they work. And so we've got no interest. As long as they keep working, we got no interest in spending more money.
There you
Well,
go.
it's for the same reason though, right? It
Yeah.
stands out because
It
everybody else
stands
has the
out.
polished end.
That's
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly
so.
what was happening. They got tons of response off of that because it was so crappy. And that's, you know, when you it, I guarantee you that if you were to start putting up ads that were just like these crappy ads that were making bold statements, you'd get a lot of people engaged. Now, whether or not it was effective as an ad, that's a different story,
Yeah.
but getting the engagement is kind of the, you know, that's the first thing you
That's the
gotta
first step,
figure
yeah.
out. So,
Cool.
hey, this is Kevin Tomlinson. It seems to me like you might need a little help. Maybe hand off all that stuff that's keeping you from writing. At Author Anchor, we connect authors with skilled, affordable virtual assistants trained specifically for the publishing world. Your personal VA handles everything from book production to marketing and social media, freeing you up to focus on what matters most, your writing. Book a discovery call today and we'll find that perfect VA for you. Plus, mention the Writers Inc. podcast and you'll get $50 off your first month. Visit authoranchor.com and get matched with your personal VA so you can just write.
Okay, on that, JD, who is up this week?
This week, we've got Riley Sager back on. He's a New York Times bestselling author of numerous novels, including Final Girls and The Only One Left. His latest is called With a Vengeance and releases June 10th. Here he is, Riley Sager.
Welcome back to the show. I believe this is your third time with us, so we appreciate you coming back to talk to us again.
Yeah, I think it is my third time, and it's always a pleasure.
Yeah, and so we've already talked about your origin story, how you got writing, so we don't need to rehash that. Before we hit that record button, we were talking a little bit about how books are sold. And I think our audience would love that conversation. So let's start there.
Yeah, like I think authors aren't really told when they're first starting out the logistics of it all and how books get to where they are and how books get in front of people and things like that. And, you know, this is my ninth book under this name for Dutton Books. And there are still things that surprise me as to the whole business aspect and the sales aspect of it. And it's very fascinating, but it also can be too much about, like, you know, how the sausage gets made a little bit. So it's, we'll try to temper it, I guess, a little.
Yeah, I love getting in the weeds, but yeah, I would love to hear what you've learned about how books get sold. Where do we start with that?
Well, I've learned that just you need to be in as many places as possible. Not just Amazon, not just Barnes & Noble, not just the indie stores. I mean, they move a lot of copies, but also libraries and the big box stores, especially the big box stores. I did not know that they were so important to the book industry. And then once I did learn this, I thought, well, of course, because so many people are in a bit of a bookstore desert. And they do their shopping at Walmart and Target and whatnot. And they might not know a book exists until they see it in one of those places. And so it's very important to be in one of those places. But then the downside is not every author can be in those places.
Yeah. And their return policies are quite, like, they can return a lot of books too. So that's a caveat.
Yeah. Oh, they can return a lot of books. Yeah. They also can order a lot of books. And sometimes they sell them. Like, I hope I'm not giving away too much information, but the only one left was a Walmart book club pick.
Mm.
And I thought, oh, this is amazing. And they ordered a ton of copies to be sold in Walmarts. And then we started noticing that they really weren't in stock.
Oh, wow.
And we were like, when are they going to be selling this book? Like, oh my gosh, what's going on here? And I got so worried. Eventually they sold every copy. So they know what they're doing, but we just don't know what that is.
Yeah. It's like mystery, mysterious algorithms that we don't have access to.
Exactly. Yes.
And so you said you were traveling, and went to ReaderLink. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, ReaderLink, for those who aren't familiar, they're a distributor and they do a lot with these big box stores. And so last year during my book tour, I was sent to visit the ReaderLink headquarters. And again, I didn't quite know who they were at the time. And I feel bad in hindsight now, but I knew it was a bit of a big deal when my editor flew to Chicago to go with me to ReaderLink.
Oh, wow.
Like, oh, this might be important. And so it was very important as an author to have these people who really get your books in front of tons of readers to really introduce yourself, get them to know you, like put my face out there. And so it was a very fun event and it was a very valuable event. And also ReaderLink has a great spread. So much. They really went all out, like with like the meats and the cheeses and the desserts.
Oh, that's so, food is the most important part of any event.
It
right?
really is. I was super impressed with them. And so, but this is a thing that like an author starting out wouldn't really know about. It was like, what is this distribution company? What do they do? Like, how do books get into libraries? How does that work? And all of these different channels for books that we as authors don't know about, and we don't even know to ask about them. I always say there's like, you don't know it until you know it, but until you know it, you had no idea that you didn't know it.
Yeah. Yeah. Getting into libraries and it's not an easy process, like looking
it's
into
not.
It as an indie, you know, the big publishers, they can do that, but it's not an easy process, but it's important.
So important.
So now that you're talking about this, about, you know, getting your books out and you're doing all these appearances, I see you on social media all the time. So I'm like, oh, there's Riley promoting something. There was a recent article in Times Magazine that was talking about all the things we need to do now as authors. It seems to be more social media. The last one of the quotes from the agent was being able to entertain a crowd while on stage. Do you feel like we're being asked to do more than we have been in the past?
Absolutely. And I think it's for everything. I think it's for movies. I think it's for recording artists. I think it's for authors, is that you have to do more to maintain the same results.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know when the tipping point is going to be where that's impossible to do, but yeah, there are with for With a Vengeance, my book that's coming out, there's two exclusive editions, one in Target, one in Barnes and Noble. It's a selection for the Once Upon a Book Club for July, I think. I'm going on a book tour, and then I had to go into New York to go to Penguin Random House, and they have an in-house studio where I recorded like a dozen videos for social media that were given to other places to use. Like Barnes and Noble just used one earlier this week.
Yeah, I think that's one I saw with the exclusive content. I saw that one
Yes.
on Instagram, so
Yeah, and it's there's just so much now that has to go into selling a book that I think probably like 20 years ago, just you didn't need to do at all.
yeah.
And there's the social media aspect, which I don't even do like a fraction of what others do because I am old and social media confuses me in many ways and I'm not good with my phone. I mean, I try, but you know, there are things like TikTok. I know
Yeah.
like BookTok is the biggest thing on earth right now. I have a TikTok account. I don't think I've used it in 2 years.
Same, and I feel bad about that.
Right. And so luckily I'm not getting any pressure from my publisher. I'd be like, hey, start churning out those TikToks. But there is a certain a balance has to be struck where there are some people, you know, you look at someone like Geneva Rose, who is so successful and she is all over social media. She's constantly on social media. And I get exhausted because I'm like, how? How are you doing
Oh,
this?
yeah, that's what I feel like. How? I'm like, how can you do that and write? Like, how do you balance both things? I don't.
Yeah, and you have to be a very, very good multitasker. And I'm
Yeah.
not at all. Yeah, I have to like devote all my focus to one thing in order to get it done.
Yeah. So, is there anything you're doing right now that surprises you that you're getting asked to do by your publishers that's new?
The video thing was new because they know I don't like doing them. Because I in the past I would get requests to record videos all the
Yeah.
time, and like as I said, like me and my phone, we do not get along. So like it would take me such a long time to just like set up the phone, get the lighting right, record something. I would take like need 50 takes just to get one sentence out, and so I really don't like doing them. And
Yeah.
so this year they said, we know you hate this, so how about we make it as easy as possible? You just come in for a day and we do it all in one sitting.
Yeah.
And then we will not ask you to do another video for the rest of the year. And I was like, okay,
Okay.
fine.
Yeah. So they made you do it. It's kind of nice that they're doing it instead of having you do it on your own, though. Just being like,
Right.
figure
And
it
the
out.
quality was so much better.
Yeah.
I saw one of them. I'm like, oh, that's what it looks like when it's professionally done.
It did look very good. And then you've got the bonus content and all of that coming out with the new book, which I don't have the bonus content, so I'm kind of jealous about that.
Oh, it's well, one of them is a Q&A, so we're probably covering some of it right now.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I'd love to talk about the new book With a Vengeance. Always a pleasure to read one of your books. So this one is a game of survival and revenge on a train. So
Yes.
I have to ask, it's a locked room mystery. We're hurtling down the rails. Was Agatha Christie's Murder on the Orient Express an influence at all, or did this idea spark from somewhere else?
it actually sparked from somewhere else. The impetus for this book is so bizarre in that, like, because I first got the idea, it was summer of 2023, and there were so many cool train scenes in movies at the time. There was Bullet Train, there was the Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, like the first half hour was on a train. Like the last half hour of Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning was on that amazing sequence with the train derailment. And so they were all so cool.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I want to write something on a train. That sounds cool. Train book. That's going to be my next thing. Train book. But then what do I do? And so I started thinking about the TV show Revenge. And I had it in my mind to always do some kind of revenge book.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, ooh, revenge on train. That sounds good. And then when you think about revenge on a train, we're going to spoil Murder on the Orient Express for those who have not read it.
If you haven't, it's too late.
It's too late. It's spoiled.
Yeah.
It's like 80 years old. You should have read it by now. But yeah, that's a whole thing. It's revenge.
Yeah.
All of them are there to kill this one person. And so my first instinct was like, oh, let's reverse that. Let's have one person there to kill everyone else. But that seemed really, one, dark, and two, the character doesn't go anywhere. Like, she's just mowing down people. And so there was no growth. There was no real narrative there. And then I started thinking, okay, what if she has to save these people?
Yeah.
And so that's when it all clicked together. And so, like, oh, she gathered them all there for revenge. She is bringing them all to justice, and someone else starts killing them. And in order to get her idea of revenge, she has to save these people. And that right there, I'm like, ooh, there's so much to explore there. There's so much potential.
Yeah. I love that you did that. You're just like, oh, this is what people would expect. And then I'll just flip that on its head. Because what did you say? This is 9 books now under this name, probably 11 or more under multiple names. People that are reading your books now are kind of expecting those twists. So how do you push yourself to keep surprising the reader?
Well, yeah, this book was hard because it takes place in 1954.
Yeah.
It's very Agatha Christie. It's very mid-century Alfred Hitchcock. And I was a little bit worried, are readers going to go along on this journey into the past? Like, it's being billed as like my first historical novel, which I don't, it's still a thriller. Like, it just happens to take place in 1954. But so I wanted to ensure that, okay, my longtime readers, like, this is still me. There are still the twists. There are still the surprises. And so I had to work, I think, a little bit extra hard in getting these twists to land. And there was a lot of revising involved where my editor, after the first draft, said, I don't think it's twisty enough.
Mm.
And I went, oh, okay. Let's figure out what else we can do here. And so then I added a bit more. And so I think my longtime readers will really enjoy it. And hopefully I'll get new readers as well because of the whole nature of the Agatha Christie-esque throwback. And
historical. And yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'm not twisty enough. There are so many possibilities in this book for who did what and so many red herrings. How did you weave that all in, all this misdirection, all these clues in your stories, and keep track of it all?
It was logistically really, really difficult. That's the thing.
I believe you.
When you set something on a train, it sounds like a good idea, but they have nowhere to go.
Yeah.
The train is just, oh, it's a series of rooms in a long line, and you can't enter one room without entering the other rooms. And so how do I accomplish that? How do I move all these characters around? And so I started to think of it as a clue board.
Mm-hmm.
And so far readers haven't picked up on this, but I make sure to say what color each of the character is wearing because I want them to sort of, in their head, subconsciously think of them as clue pieces on the board.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And it helped me also keep track of, like, oh, okay, she's the one in red. She's the one, he's the one in the green suit. She's the one wearing gray. And it helped me to sort of mentally move them back and forth throughout the train. And a big difficulty was, as you said, I wanted it to feel like every single person could be responsible, but also that no one could be responsible.
I love that.
So I want it to be everyone is a possibility, but also this is impossible. And so that was very hard to really, it took a lot of plotting and planning and revising to really figure it all out.
I just love that you said that everybody could have been responsible, but also no one could have been responsible. And that just takes it to the next level. And now I'm trying to put colors to all the characters. Anna is Miss Scarlet. I got to think.
Exactly.
Well.
Definitely. Yes.
That's amazing. And so you said you did a lot of editing because I was curious because you start with a body discovery of the body scene.
Yes.
Which happens later in the book. And then you kind of rewind back to how we got there. Was that part of the editorial process or was that kind of how you?
No, that one I knew that the first scene with the body is the first thing I wrote because I knew, I mean, it's a really complex situation that Anna has created for herself. And so I knew there was going to be a lot of world building and a lot of necessary backstory. And just because we have her, you know, accomplice, we have the six people who destroyed her family.
Yeah.
You need to introduce all of them, sort of hint at their motivation, their reasons for doing it. And then you had to address the rules of the train. And that was something that surprised me as I was writing, because as I was going through it, all these questions started popping into my head. Like, why don't they just jump off the train?
Yeah.
And I knew that, okay, if I'm thinking that, the reader is going to think that. And so I need to address it. So then I had to explain why they can't jump off the train because they will die. And
yeah, it's fast and there's a blizzard and they're over water. Yeah. And yeah, it was all that great stuff.
And so every scenario, like as I would think of like, wait, why don't they do this? Why don't they pull the emergency brake? Why don't they just break into the locomotive? So I had to address all of those. And so the first third of the book kept getting longer and longer and longer. And so I'm very glad I did that murder in the first three pages because I want people to stay for the ride.
Right.
And so it was important to plant that question immediately. Like, who's the dead person? Because I don't identify them.
Right.
Who are these people on this train? Why are they on the train? And who killed this person? And I knew, hopefully, that if the readers have those questions in their head, they will stick around for when the answers arrive much later in the book.
Yeah, I love that. And I've seen you done that in a few of your books. You just drop us straight into the trouble in media res, as they would say, I guess. And I stop and look at that because it's tricky to balance the disorientation with giving the readers kind of a foothold. So I'm curious if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, sometimes it is too much at first. In some of my books, I have had to finesse it or tone it down or even rewrite it entirely just to ease audience, like readers, into what's happening. Because sometimes it is just like, plonk, here you are. You're confused right now, but trust me, you'll know later. And I do it a lot because one, it just works every time.
It does work, yeah.
And two, my books are pretty slow burn, I would say. Like because I write standalones, it's a new situation every time. It's a new location, new characters, new time period, new everything. And so I need that time to really build up all the stuff. There's a payoff. There really is. I make sure of it every book. But it does take a lot of pages to really dig down deep into the story. And so that's why I do try to always start off with like the bit of intrigue that will hopefully pique the reader's interest enough for them to, because I see my goal as an author is just to try to guide them to the final page.
Right.
Like really that's the goal, is like, just, I don't want anyone to not finish one of my books. I'm sure there are many, many, many people who haven't finished my books, but like, that's the goal. It's like, if you read page one, I want you to read the last page as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And I noticed you did the countdown clock with the headers too. How many hours till Chicago, which is always a great technique.
The ticking clock. That's another thing that I learned, where it's just, like anytime you can get a ticking clock in there, do it. And it was just natural with this kind of book, because train, they're on a schedule, they're set to arrive at this time. And so that I thought worked.
Yeah.
It was just obvious to do. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, that's brilliant. I love that. It worked very well.
I fudged the time a little bit because, like, I think it takes longer to get from Philadelphia to Chicago by train than 13 hours, but 13 just seemed like a great number.
Yeah. 13 is a great number for a thriller. We love 13. So, like you said, you're always doing a different idea. This one is a classic train. I've actually ridden a train very much like the one you describe. It's called the California Zephyr, and you can still ride it in Akron, Ohio. It's like this beautiful chrome.
I don't know, is it
Art Deco? Have you ridden these before?
It's a beautiful. I have not. My research, because people ask like, "Oh, did you write this on a train?" I'm like, "No."
Yeah.
I did not. The only train I went on during the writing of this book was NJ Transit. So there was, and that does not count.
No.
No, but there's so, I did a lot of train research.
Yeah.
And I discovered just how cool they are and how fascinating. And like, yeah, the California Zephyr, there was the 20th beautiful. Century. There was, oh God, I can't think of the other, but there were so many like iconic trains, and they were so important to American life in the 40s and 50s. And that's one of the reasons I set the book during that time period, because it was the main mode of transportation. If you wanted to go a long distance, you hopped on that train. And they were so glamorous.
Yeah.
They're
beautiful.
There's this luxuriousness to train travel that just does not exist at all anymore.
Yeah. I was blown away when we got to ride that train with like the mirrors and the mirror, everything inside is art. Like you can ride the observation car and it's all glass at the top. So very cool. Anytime you're in Akron, Ohio, go hop on that train.
I'll have to do that. Cause that was one of the trains that did inspire it's called the Philadelphia Phoenix, because that sounds like it's such a train name.
It is. Yeah.
And so, yeah, the Zephyr was one of the inspirations. It's a whole bunch of trains cobbled together to make this one fictional one.
That's very cool. I was wondering if you had a chance to ride one. So in the future.
In the future, definitely.
All right. Well, this interview time has just flown by. So I think I'd just like to wrap up by asking, where do you think publishing is headed now in terms of what's going on next? What's the market looking for? Where are you looking to for the future?
Oh, gosh. It's so unpredictable. This is why I tell people, I always get asked, like, what advice do you have for writers? I'm like, write the book you want to read. Because if you chase a trend, I guarantee that trend is going to be over by the time your book gets published.
Yeah.
But I have no idea where anything is going now. It's a very uncertain time for publishing because I feel like we're kind of careening into a recession, possibly. Yeah. I think people are cutting back on their spending. And so I think like discounting is going to be a part of how books are sold. And we're already seeing it a little bit this year. For big genres, I don't know. Like cozies seem to be making a big comeback.
They do, yeah.
And that's always cool because I like those. I don't know. I'm I'm doing my thing, and hopefully it will fit in enough or stand out enough in the future market. But it's a very uncertain time. I don't think anyone knows in publishing like what's going to happen next, and I think it's making a lot of people nervous.
Yeah, I think so too. I love you said that, fit in enough or stand out enough. Standing out,
yeah, because
too. Yeah,
it's standing out does work, and I've been very lucky in that, and this has not been planned, but I've tended to stay a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of things. Like my books come out, like, you know, Gothic is now a big thing. And so like, I think like the only one left, which is all Gothic, just happened just right as that was starting. And that was not planned. I didn't have this crystal ball. It just was, oh, I want to write this book.
Yeah.
And so I've been very lucky in that regard. And I'm like, yeah, my luck's going to run out at some point.
We hope not, because I love reading your book. So,
oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on, and I hope to have you on again.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, next year.
It is so nice to have repeat authors back on, because we kind of get deeper into some things.
You can say that again.
Yeah, it was cool. We were talking about, you know, the logistics of how books are sold.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, what do you wish you knew about that before you got started?
That's a JD question right there.
Yeah, I'm trying. There's so much. And like now being with Simon & Schuster, like, you know, the curtain's really been pulled back, and I'm starting to see some of these other things, you know, just how you get in front of, you know, just like Goodreads, you know, like the actual Goodreads newsletters and, you know, all these other services that are out there that fill up your inbox. It's like a never ending thing. And like what he was talking about with Walmart, you know, like I've seen that, like they come in and they will buy pallets of books, you know, like, yeah. I saw it with Costco. I think 10, 20,000 copies, you know, went out the door to them. You've got no clue, you know, whether they're going to move those or not. You know, you walk into your local store looking for it, you don't find it, you know, like that kind of stuff can freak you out. And every single one of those books can come back. Like you never even hear the term returns as an indie author, because yeah. Most indie authors don't allow returns. Right. But in the trad world, you have to allow it. And that's how you get in front of a lot of these different things. I'm constantly looking for new ways to sell books though. Like I just did a program with a woman, who runs this thing out of the Hamptons where she puts books in all the hotel rooms. And then she does a promotion locally in the Hamptons. You know, there's a ton of press that, you know, we got, and that moved a lot of copies, you know, like not only, you know, I had to give away a few copies, but I just, you know, I sent them back catalog stuff that it already had. So it wasn't a big deal. To do stuff like that, you know, with something I keep upstairs, you know, which is based here locally, you know, like a local haunted house. I reached out to everybody in this area in New England that does tours, you know, so we've got bike tours, we've got walking tours, all these different things. And I gave them discounts on copies of the books. And now they're selling those books out of their shops to all the tours that come in. Yeah. We're moving a lot of copies doing that. So like, I guess it doesn't really matter whether you're indie or trad, but like looking for all of the things, you know, like trying all these different things, that's what really matters and helps you stand out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just like be evolving, right? So like you may start out and you may not be comfortable with doing returns on Ingram, but then wait until you are and then change it up. Like I recently changed it so that stores could put it in the shelves, and I've had a few that have reached out for it. And like just knowing that you should be ever changing in your products and make sure that they become more and more accessible is just really important to me.
That's a really good piece of advice, actually, is to occasionally revisit what you're doing, because there are limitations that kind of come onto you involuntarily when you kind of start out. One of those, like, for example, audiobooks. You know, I didn't bother with audiobooks in the first part of my career because it was just too expensive. I couldn't swing it. But over time, those circumstances changed, but I still kind of had the habit of ignoring that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still kind of a catch-up thing for me now, but I mean, now I'm embracing it. I'm seeing the benefits of it. So you need to periodically just look at how your business is going, you know, whether you're trad or indie, honestly. And the things that you're doing, the things that you put off doing that you know would benefit you, that maybe now you have the resources to do. That's good advice.
Yeah. Businesses that don't continue to evolve kind of tend to die.
I had a come to Jesus moment yesterday. Because I've been doing a lot of TikTok shop, and so I have to pack my own orders. And I make my orders very pretty and very fancy. And I was talking with a friend of mine, and she's very successful with TikTok shop. And she made me time how I was packing and give back how long it was taking me to pack. And I was like, you have to cut X, Y, and Z. And I was like, oh, damn it, you're right. But this is something that, like, I had to take a moment. I had to revisit what I've been used to doing for months now and sort of realize, like, you're doing a little too much. You're spending too much time doing this, whereas you could be writing, whereas you could be doing these other pieces. So
yeah,
just always looking at your process and how to make it better.
Yeah.
I always try to scale everything in my head. So like what you just mentioned, you know, when I first come up with that idea, I look at it and say, okay, it works as a one-off. What happens if I have to do 500 of these, 1,000 of these, you know, like how does that play out, and try to figure out all those moving parts, because at some point there is a breaking point.
Yeah. Always look at your ROI.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk a little bit about Riley's book. Always a pleasure to read one of his books. They're always so well plotted and interesting. The idea of conceptualizing characters as those from Clue, like Clue, but that was just fascinating to me. I could see everyone as their own character and visually laid out. And just that something he said really stuck with me. He wanted everyone to be responsible, but nobody could be responsible. I'd just love to hear your thoughts on those things.
Sounds like modern politics.
I think that's the way Agatha Christie approached a lot of her books. And I guess now we can go listen to AI Agatha Christie to find out if that's true or not. But I, you know, she wrote him, all of them, in a way where literally the killer could be anybody. And I think she may not have known who the killer was. And, you know, when you pants a novel, I think that really helps, because, you know, if you have it outlined, you know, even in your head, it's subconscious, but, you know, you're going to let things sneak out because you know who it is. You know, if you're pantsing the novel and you've got no clue, that's helpful. I've changed it up, you know, like mid book, just to trick myself, you know, like I go into it thinking it's going to be this person. And I said, it'd be way cooler if it's this person, but it couldn't possibly be this person, which means that's who I need to make it be. You know, and I've changed it up that way as well.
All the red herrings have to have a really strong motive to have done it. You know, that's, and that's difficult. That's difficult to pull off, because, you know, there's always, even the hero, even the protagonist should have, like, deep down, some motive that they, if you're talking about something like a murder or a theft or whatever, like, there should be a question mark over every head in that story, even the good guy.
I always, you know, the bit of the thinking and shift in thinking for me was, I always think everybody could have done it, but then when he said, but nobody could have done it, that was a kind that kind of,
yeah, that's
difficult.
Yeah. I want him to write down, maybe he can do a book or something about how to use Clue as the model for your storytelling. I've been obsessed recently with Dan Harmon's Story Circle.
It's good.
And I've been kind of just trying to, and I've been trying to apply it to, I've had AI applying it to my books to see how well it does with that. And it's not good at that, by the way, just an aside, it's not good at it's like it generated a graphic showing you how this applies to my books, and it like repeats itself three times in the same circle. The lines don't line up. It's crazy. But anyway, all that aside, like I tend to not rely on any of these formulas, but I like seeing them because they kind of help me visualize how I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to see his version of that played out in Clue. Could turn that into a whole like writer's course. You're playing Clue to learn how to write a mystery. That would be
seriously locked door mystery is perfect. It's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
The other thing that I thought was interesting was when we were talking about kind of looking at where are things going in terms of the publishing industry, where did he think they were going? And of course, nobody can predict that. When he said you kind of hope you can fit in enough or stand out enough. And I love the or stand out enough part. How do you do that? How do you make sure your book is or stand out?
You make
out
really
enough?
Crappy graphics.
Stickmen.
Stickmen.
I mean, I personally haven't played by the rules since I started, and that seems to be working out. And a lot of the people that I know that do play by the rules 100%, they're the ones who tend to get lost. And, in a lot of ways they, they end up quitting, they end up in the mid list somewhere and they don't feel like they're making any progress. And eventually they just give up because they're not willing to try something new. They just do everything their agent tells them, everything their editor tells them, and take it as gospel. And nobody knows the answers, including the publishing industry.
I think Riley said something about how don't just write the book that that you would want to read, that you would want, and don't worry about chasing trends or whatever. And I do think that what we see a lot of, and this is going to be much more challenging for people who are writing for a traditional market because they basically want a formula. I mean, they want a known quantity, but on the indie side in particular, like the books that end up hitting are the ones that were just fun little projects that author thought I'd love to see this book exist, and then they go do it. I think that is a key, especially now because AI is getting so abused in our industry, and there's so many books that are just clones. If you can come up with something truly original and do it in a truly unique and authentic voice, like you're going to gain traction.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot because AI is so imitative. It's really important to be innovative right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I guess with that, JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got New York Times bestseller Laura Lippman coming on. Since her debut in 1997, Laura has been recognized as one of the most gifted and versatile crime novelists working. Her series novels, standalones, and short stories have all won major awards, including the Edgar and Anthony. She's here to talk craft and tell us all about her latest book, which is called Murder Takes a Vacation and releases June 17th. Laura Lippman.
Yeah, our conversation was a blast. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.